Catch a breeze so soft. The wind is singing when it took me off. I heard a noise far away from above. Tears follow when the sun comes up.
Chapter 4. Shmi meets Owen's father, Cleeg, who falls in love with her. He's a good man, kind and patient. He's taken good care of both Beru and Linathan, given them a place to stay and heal. He's opened his home to the Freedom Trail, and offers each slave who makes a stop there nothing but kindness and understanding. He's thoughtful, compassionate, and caring. But she doesn't love him. In another life, the prospect of freedom is enough to get her to say yes to his proposal to buy her, free her, and marry her. The Amavikan have an expression for someone who does this. They call it gilding the chains and calling it a necklace. Or sometimes just giving someone jewelry. She can see how easily she might fall to the temptation of it in a harder life where there is less hope. Gilded chains are better than iron chains, and Cleeg is a nice man, if slightly clueless, and a foresight better than Watto. She could have a good life as his wife. Being a moisture farmer is hard work, and often lonely, but she would be lonely anyway, with her son off in distant parts, making a better life for himself, becoming a hero. In this life, he is also off in distant parts, making a better life for himself, becoming a hero. But he's a hero who visits her. In this life, she has adopted not just Kitster, Beru, and Owen as her children, in addition to Annie, but also Ben and half of Mos Espa's youth who come to her for medical care and advice on anything under the two suns of Tatooine, from their love woes to their worries for family, their eagerness to do something, to strike a crushing blow to the Hutts. She helps them find their niche in the rebellion, and tells them that their time will come sooner than they think, but maybe not as soon as they hope for. In this life, there is much to do in Mos Espa. She's at the heart of the slave revolution, the best hope they've had in centuries to end slavery once and for all, and she won't let it pass her by. She's one of the grandmothers of Mos Espa, and her place is here. She says no. Cleeg asks again, if not for him, then to make Owen and Beru truly her son and daughter. He doesn't understand. They already are. Anakin takes all of his indignation, his passion, and his righteous anger, and channels it towards the Hutts. He is the captain of one of the largest pirate ships, and regularly has up to 30 or 50 refugees on board. They take normal smuggling jobs as well. Even freedom fighter pirates need to eat. But most of what they do is directed toward the liberation of Tatooine. Naboo is one of the most fervent supporters of the struggle, even if much of it happens in secret, because Naboo still remembers the blockade a decade and a half ago. This has strengthened their resolve to stand up against the powerful who exploit the weak, but to do so wisely. Naturally, Padme and Anakin see each other frequently. They are good friends who've kept in contact since they were both children. Annie fell for Padme the first time he laid eyes on her, and this childish devotion has blossomed into a mature love based on an appreciation of her strength, her kindness, and beauty. Padme takes the longer way around to love. She feels fondly for him, naturally, but she does not realize she is falling in love with him until she is in the middle of it. Pretty much all of her handmaidens saw it before she did, which amuses them endlessly. Padme falls in love with Annie when they are back-to-back dodging blaster fire, arguing over who the bounty hunters are really trying to kill. Padme has made a fair few enemies as a senator championing for justice for the downtrodden. Annie has made his hitting the slavers in the money belt. She falls in love when she sees Annie carrying a Rhodian baby, so the mother, who came as a refugee on one of his runs, can finally sleep. She falls in love sitting around campfires telling stories. Not the secret stories of the Amavikan, those she learns later, but childhood stories of growing up with Ben and Shmi, of getting into trouble with Kitster and Nelly. She has a feeling he edits these stories very carefully. They are all about getting into trouble with their parents and guardians, never with their owners. And when she asks once, his face becomes shuttered and he changes the topic. She doesn't ask again. Of sneaking out to look at the stars and knowing that one day he would be among them. And she tells him of pranks played with her sister, of staying up with her handmaidens and drinking cacao at midnight, of feeling out of her depth knowing that an entire planet depended on her, but knowing that she had the best support possible in the handmaidens, and that most other people who wanted the job were idiots. He tells her how much he hates sand, and how little she reminds him of it. It is an awkward speech, but she finds it oddly charming. And that's when she knows that she truly loves this man, that it's more than just a crush. When she finds even his most fumbling attempts at romance charming. Had someone else compared her to sand, no matter how favorably, she would have thought there was something wrong with them. Annie proposes, and she says yes, because she does truly love him. In another life, they rush into it, knowing they could be separated at any moment when Annie has to return to the Jedi and there is a war brewing. In this life, Padme is caught up in the middle of a war, and there is another war brewing. In secret, under their control. But they are more certain about seeing each other again. They don't have to rush into anything. The Republic considers Anakin a pirate, thief, and terrorist, and it would be extremely impolitic to bind herself to him openly. Even the fact that they know each other is held secret. It's well known that Naboo supports the freedom of all slaves, and that many refugees end up on Naboo, but so far they've managed to avoid any official connection between the political power of Naboo and the criminal activities of the slave rebellion. This means Padme can take the moral high ground and be mostly believable when she advocates nonviolence and a peaceful end to the conflict, even though she is not above taking up a blaster when she needs to, and she understands that slaves will not win their freedom by asking for it. Still, it helps their cause to have her be seen as the peaceful, legitimate side, in opposition to the slaver's violence. She's uncomfortable with the idea of a secret marriage. If it gets out, she can explain a secret affair, but a marriage is another thing entirely. On Naboo, weddings are big, elaborate affairs, and it doesn't feel right not to do it properly. She always chafed at having to hide her marriage. Here, she has someone she can go to with her concerns. Shmi counsels her on both politics and private matters. Annie doesn't mind a secret marriage. The slaves of Tatooine are used to secret marriages. In another life, he would echo her, say that their marriage should be public, that she deserves more than this. But he also chafes for his own sake. He would want something better than a slave marriage. He should have left that life behind him. In this life, he has fewer concerns about that. He's not left his roots behind, as he has elsewhere. He knows that when slavery is over, he and Padme can be open with their relationship. He's no stranger to waiting to announce a marriage until it's safe. Shmi counsels patience. They should wait, so they don't do anything they might regret. Amavikan marriages are often secret, but Padme is not Amavikan. They know they love each other and will stay with each other. The official marriage can come later. Annie is still sought after as a terrorist and pirate, according to the Republic. It's not politic for Padme to bind herself to him while he's still considered a criminal. Be wise. Be patient, Shmi says. Their time will come. And their time is coming. The rebellion in Haven is gaining ground. The pirate fleet is bringing them more blasters and grenades, and they have freed slaves hiding in Mos Espa and Mos Eisley, ready for the coordinated attack on the huts. When Annie and the mechanics finally complete the global signal jammers, they know it's time. In one night, the slaves of Tatooine rise up, break free, capture or kill as many Dithran as they can get to, and start building barricades. The fleet brings back those who went elsewhere, bringing more ships and more free allies, and they stay to offer protection to those marching below from Haven. It's a sight to behold. Thousands upon thousands of slaves walking with purpose, and yet more in the ships above them, keeping the hut's fighter planes away from them. The Dithran cower in their houses, waiting for the inevitable. Some take to the streets to meet the rebellion, but they don't have the numbers, and with the signal jammer blocking any transmissions to set off the chips, they don't have the technological advantage. On the evening of the second day of fighting in Mos Espa, they break through the defenses of Gardula's palace, where pandemonium reigns. They haven't managed to smuggle weapons into Gardula's palace, leaving the slaves in a weaker position. But they are fighting for their freedom and their lives, and the battle is not as unbalanced as one might initially expect. But the reinforcements of the other slaves are well needed, and with them, the tide is turned. It's Ben who takes her down, who stands above her with a blaster, ready to fire at point-blank range.
"You dare, slave! You dare with a blaster and the mighty Cthulhu of it! I gave you everything, a position in my household. I trusted you, and you betray me like this. I gave you a position above the rest of the rabble. I saw your potential and nurtured it. And now you prove that you are nothing more than a dog and worthy to lick my slime. I will make you pay for this. I will have your head and your mother's head and your precious brother's head."
She rages. "You gave me nothing. I owe you nothing," Ben returns. "You call me a dog, but I am a person, and my name is Ben." He doesn't shoot. Instead, he orders Gardula bound with the chains she used on her slaves. She signs over all her wealth to the rebellion, frees all her slaves, and promises to return to Nalhutta and live out the rest of her life in peace there. She intends to double-cross them, of course, but Annie's crew take her to Nalhutta and dump her unceremoniously in a swamp with nothing to her name. Annie is not as noble as his brother, but he doesn't hurt her. Much. Jabba is blown up by his own major domo, who loses a leg in the process. "It was worth it," he grins in every retelling of the story he gives in years to come, waving his mechanical prosthetic, built by Annie, around. Annie and he share stories of how they lost their limbs and became unfettered for many years to come, and each gains a brother from the experience. The Amavi can celebrate their freedom around bonfires, dancing in the streets, and singing as the three moons of Tatooine smile down on them. The next day, they get to work. The signal jammer prevents the Diporon from detonating the slave ships, deliberately or from afar, but the geographical restrictions are still in place. The clinics are full to bursting with former slaves who want their chips removed, and Shmi and the other grandmothers, grandfathers, and grandparents are overworked making sure everyone has food, water, and shelter. The younger freedom fighters are keeping the chaos under control, making sure looting and violence is kept to a minimum. They set up a system to reunite people with their friends and family. After the first period of chaos, things settle down. The moisture farmers return to their isolated farms. With willing volunteers from the newly freed slaves who fancy taking up farming, the people settle in to rebuild something from the shatters of the economy. The Tatooine economy, controlled by the Hutts, ran on slavery, smuggling, and gambling. Smuggling and gambling still form a major part of the reformed economy, but the crucial difference is that the cargo and the stakes are no longer sentient. Tatooine will never be an easy place to live, but it is no longer what Obi-Wan Kenobi, because he was still Obi-Wan, only living under an alias, called a wretched hive of scum and villainy. Ben Skywalker, who is no longer Obi-Wan, has never called any place on Tatooine a wretched hive of scum and villainy. Not because it isn't, but because it is so much more. He has, however, on occasion called it the arse end of the galaxy, this force-forsaken rock, and a pit of misery and despair. He is well aware of its faults. The newly freed slaves are all traumatized, and on top of that, no matter how short or long, they have been in battle. This is a time for healing, for working out what to do now that they are masters over their own fates, and don't have anybody who will tell them what they must do. This is a time to fix the planet, and from there, the galaxy. Amavikan culture has always been matriarchal and matrilineal, as well as marked by a respect for the elders of the community. They form a council of elders, made up of the grandmothers, grandfathers, and grandparents of the communities of Tatooine. But unlike other councils, including that of the Jedi, the council of elders meets openly, in public, and anyone can come to listen and speak. Nobody is voiceless on the new Tatooine. Shmi is one of the unofficial leaders. Sometimes the official leader, when off-worlders demand someone in authority to talk to, even though their culture doesn't work that way. She, who has adopted so many children that were not hers by birth, who has at one point given counsel to probably every slave in Mos Espa, who ran the clinics that took out the chips and gave food and healthcare to those who didn't have the means to supply it themselves, who raised two of the most prominent freedom fighters in the galaxy. When Shmi speaks, most people listen. Ben takes on the role of chief administrator. It's not one he particularly relishes. He would much rather be on the front lines of the next battle, but he's good at it. And he's one of the few people who can navigate Gardula's file system and archives without losing either his sanity or his limbs. The guerrilla general becomes a secretary and a diplomat. He has help from Gardula's majordomo, who took on many of Ben's roles both in her household and in the rebellion when Ben left. Ben will always stand on Shmi's right-hand side. He can't stand on someone's left any longer. Annie takes the fleet, those who aren't left behind for planetary defense, and goes back out into space. Tatooine may be free, but there are still many planets where slavery is rampant. There is still plenty of work for a pirate, smuggler, freedom fighter. Ben envies him, and vows that when his work in Mos Espa is done, he will join him. He knows his work in Mos Espa will never be done. To the outside world, the Skywalkers have schismed since the liberation of Tatooine, and with them, the liberated slaves. There's Shmi and Ben on Tatooine, extending mercy to former slavers who are willing to give up their occupation, starting to feel out Republic worlds for diplomatic links, vocally decrying the violent tactics used by the rebel pirates. The pirates, in turn, deride the peaceful attempts at diplomacy and negotiation as useless. Padme visits the free Tatooine with her fiancé. He doesn't particularly want to show it to her. He may be closer to his roots in this life, but he is still no fonder of the planet. But she wants to see how the planet has developed since she was there last, and there is very little he can deny her if it's within his power to give. And she sees that they are as close as they ever were. They comm call frequently, and most of Ben's plans factor in Annie, and vice versa. The planets that refuse to consider any negotiations with Tatooine are the ones that Annie hits with greatest force. Ben is the carrot, Annie the stick. They work best when presented as alternatives to each other. In another life, Obi-Wan Kenobi devoted himself to the Jedi Code. In this life, Ben Skywalker's morals are no less strong, but there is more room for maneuver in them. Ben was not only brought up on cautionary tales of the dangers of the dark side, he was also brought up on stories of Ekreth the Trickster. He knows how to manipulate, how to twist the facts to suit himself, how to pull strings without being noticed. The revolution spreads to other planets along the Outer Rim, through Hutt Space to Ryloth. Ryloth is not officially a slave planet, since it belongs to the Republic where slavery is illegal, but everyone knows that Senator Orn Frieta is a slaver. He's unseated by freedom fighter Sham Zandula. And from there to Nal Hutta itself. Nal Hutta is still a Hutt stronghold, as most of the Hutts have been driven back to there, but every single slave on Nal Hutta is freed, prompting a day of celebration on most of the planets in what was, but is no longer, Hutt space. Officially, the newly freed planets are independent, not aligned with either the Republic or Separatists, or indeed any other group. Unofficially, it's well known that the people of Ryloth, Zygeria, Ratatak, Tatooine, and all the other ex-slave worlds consult each other before they do anything. There is another revolution that progresses concurrently and together with the slave revolution. The droid revolution. 3PO is a member of the Skywalker family. R2-D2 is Padme's loyal companion. They both have both sapience and sentience. Why shouldn't they also be free to determine their own fate? Droids who develop independency clauses in their code, either programmed by allies and spread from droid to droid, or in rarer cases spontaneously developed, are taken in by the revolution and slowly start going undercover both in Republic and Separatist space to spread the code to other droids. Viruses with the Freedom Code are uploaded onto the holonet, and organic slicers struggle to keep up. After all, it is very hard to outslice artificial intelligences. The Skywalkers and Tatooine are suddenly important to the galaxy. They control one of the main hyperspace lanes, and while the Jedi failed spectacularly in their attempt to negotiate with Gardula the Hutt for access, Qui-Gon will forever be known as the Jedi who blew up the home of the person he was trying to negotiate with. They feel they might have better luck with Shmi Skywalker, spokesperson for Tatooine. After all, the Jedi and the Skywalkers have enjoyed a friendly relationship historically. That being said, they don't send Qui-Gon. They don't want to tempt fate too much. Things tend to happen around Qui-Gon Jinn, much the same way they happened around Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker in another story. The Jedi send Yon Dooku, and with him comes Bail Organa to represent the Republic. Alderaan has not been as closely involved in the slave rebellion as Naboo, but it's sympathetic, and it too has housed many refugees. Bail is a good friend of Padmé Amidala, whose links to the rebellion are not as secret as she would wish them to be. The fact that she knows the notorious pirate Anakin Skywalker personally is something of an open secret in the Senate. Yon Dooku and Shmi Skywalker greet each other cordially, as friends of friends who may well become friends themselves. They each recognize a core of steel in the other that they can respect. The negotiations are to take place in the council chamber in the House of the People, built on the ruins of Gardula's palace. It brings Shmi great satisfaction to see this powerful symbol of the power of the people built on the ruins of the symbol of the slavers who have been cast off. The council chamber is designed to let everyone have a say, built as a large, gently sloping amphitheater. The Council of Elders usually sits in the middle, facing the audience, leading the discussion. There are a few scattered participants who have come to see the negotiations, but mostly it is the Council of Elders and the Republicans around a table. Dooku is used to these negotiations taking place in private, closed quarters, and is a bit put off by the openness the Tatooinians show. There is one snag, however. Dooku comes with his close second-in-command, Cody, and both Dooku and Bail are protected by clone bodyguards. Clones, who trigger the scanners installed in the antechamber of the council chambers, the scanners that are mainly displayed in recognition of their slave past. The scanners that were used to detect the location of implanted slave chips. The presence of microchips or restraining bolts in sentient beings is something that the Amavikan will never be happy with. Dooku and Bail know that something is happening, but they don't know what. They know that something flashed and gave off a tiny beep, and that the faces of their hosts have turned pinched and drawn, and that they're talking with each other in quiet voices. But then Shmi smiles, and it is nowhere near as warm as it was when she first met them at the bottom of the ramp of their spaceship, but both men pretend not to notice. Shmi invites both Bail and Dooku to sit at the table they have placed in the middle of the amphitheater for this discussion, and then she invites Cody and the other clones of Ghost Company, Waxer, Boyle, and Wooly, to join them, claiming that they are all equal in the House of the People. The clones exchange glances, but say they prefer to stand. They have been brought along as bodyguards, and they can fulfill that duty best by standing. Bail is quick to point out that this is standard practice, and they don't actually believe the Tatooinians to be a threat. Shmi calms them and reassures them that she is not at all insulted, but leaves the offer open should they change their minds. Ben has prepared a few documents for her, outlining what Gardula would have asked for, what they need the most, and what they are in a position to offer. But he takes a seat in the back of the amphitheater, where he can still hear what's going on, but will hopefully not attract the attention of the Jedi. Dooku opens by laying out the mutual benefits the Republic and Tatooine can gain from each other. The Republic needs access to hyperlanes, Tatooine is still rebuilding its economy after the recent upheavals, and can gain from trade when ships on said hyperlane stop there. They would be more than welcome to apply to join the Republic, a process which shouldn't take too long, in which case the Republic would be willing to offer them aid in rebuilding, as well as help from the Jedi to maintain the peace. Shmi smiles coolly. "You lad a good argument, Master Jedi," she says. "You're right that we have much to gain from each other. And we, too, believe in the Republic ideals of democracy, justice, equality, and peace. We would be honored to enter into an alliance with you, and perhaps even seek to join the Republic. But we will not work with anyone who uses, benefits from, or condones slavery." "Slavery is illegal in the Republic," Dooku says with a frown. "Are you not even now using an army of slaves to fight your war for you?" she asks. "Created to serve you and implanted with control chips in their brains?" Cody shifts uneasily. There have been some mutterings in the barracks about the Jedi and the Republic using them as expendable cannon fodder. There have been some clones who haven't been suited for battle at all, who would much rather have settled down to be farmers on some backwater planet somewhere, but have stayed for their brothers, or because they didn't want to be deserters. And those chips are troubling. He knows they're meant to inhibit aggression, but the thought that someone else can control his brain doesn't sit well with him at all. "The chips are inhibitors. They limit their aggression," Dooku says, still frowning. "If that was all they did, they wouldn't have set off our sensors," Shmi says. "And I find it very troubling that the Jedi would accept beings with chips implanted to alter their behavior. That seems at odds with your professed ideals of democracy, justice, equality, and peace. To be honest, as former slaves, it makes us very uneasy that you don't see this as reprehensible as we do." Bail chimes in at this point, seeing the frown lines deepen even further on Dooku's face. "We do find it reprehensible, at least some of us, and I would say many of us, even. Certain senators, myself and Senator Amidale included, are working closely with the Jedi Order to get the clones recognized as full citizens of the Republic. But unfortunately, it's taking some time. The Jedi are in command because they know the clones as individuals. They're able to tell them apart in the Force. And we're confident that they'll treat the men under their command with dignity until such a time comes that they are recognized as full citizens." Cody is well aware of the clone rights bill that has been going around the Senate for 2 years now, never getting anywhere. He doesn't have much hope of it being passed, especially not while the war is still in full swing. He doesn't know what will happen after the war. He hopes that he and his brothers will get some recognition for what they have given and sacrificed for the Republic, but from what he has seen, the Republic senators take forever to get anything done, and rarely do anything that isn't of direct benefit to themselves. As for the Jedi being better than others, that's certainly true. He has faith in the Jedi Order as the generals of the Gar, but he knows that there are better Jedi and worse ones. Every brother knows what happened with the 501st under Pong Krell. Dooku is one of the better ones. He's strict and demanding, and at first Cody thought him unfeeling, but he's learned that it's just that Dooku is uncomfortable with any expression of emotion, and that he in fact goes out of his way to ensure that as many clones as possible survive battle, and not just out of strategic concern. Shmi has heard this argument before. Watto was keen on it. He treated her decently, by certain standards, and better him than Gardula, he was fond of reminding her. It didn't change the fundamental fact that she was his slave. And that undermined any decency he showed her. A truly decent owner would free her, not gild the chains. And even Watto's chains were decidedly ungilded. But she can tell that Senator Organa's heart is in the right place, and he is sincere in his wish to help the clones. It does set my mind at ease to know that the clones of champions such as yourselves fighting for their cause while they fight for the Republic. But that doesn't change the fact that they are not free, and we won't treat with any world that keeps slaves. I dearly wish the situation was not what it is, because I must turn you down. But I invite you to come again as soon as the clones are freed. And until then, know that any clone soldier or any former slave from a Republic world will find sanctuary on Tatooine, no matter what. We are a haven to all who wish to be free. They don't reach much more progress that night. The talks are wrapped up, but since they all like each other, despite not being able to reach an agreement, the Republic delegation is in no hurry to be off. They share an evening meal, and are offered accommodations in Mos Espa. The city is finding its feet again, and there's a sense of vibrancy and relief in the air. They're introduced to Shmi's son, Ben, who's charming and witty, but seems to prefer to stay in the background. As far as rumor has it, he was fairly vital to the rebellion. But nobody can quite agree on what he did. Bail also, hesitantly, brings up Shmi's other son, the terrorist. "Well, of course I don't condone his means and methods," Shmi says diplomatically. "An untruth, but not a complete one. She would prefer the liberation to be possible without the loss of life, but unfortunately it's not. But he is my son, and I won't cut him off. We do try to keep conversation away from contentious topics, though. This, on the other hand, is an outright lie. Most slaves are very practiced liars, and the Republic contingent does not sense anything amiss." "Then it's a coincidence that he always targets those who turn you down for negotiations?" Dooku asks shrewdly. "Not at all," Shmi replies. "He targets the worst of the slavers, and those tend to be the very people who won't treat with former slaves. There is nothing coincidental about it." It is a plausible explanation that convinces absolutely nobody. Much less Dooku himself. He lets it pass. He can't honestly say that he disapproves, even though he must pretend to as a Jedi. Jedi are supposed to stand against needless violence, but he is not convinced that it is needless, even if the Senate and the Jedi High Council have declared it so. "If we do reach a treaty, we would probably want some kind of guarantee that he and his fleet don't target Republic citizens," Dooku cautions. "I can't control Anakin," Shmi says. "But he'll stop when there are no slavers. If you don't want him to go after Republic citizens, I suggest you make sure no Republic citizens get involved in the slave trade." "I fear that is as much beyond me as controlling the Tatooinean pirate fleet is beyond you," Dooku says. "That's a pity," Shmi says. There is very little doubt that that is the end of the conversation. The delegation leaves the next morning. When Anakin finds out about the clones with chips in their heads, he hits the roof. He calls most of the fleet to an emergency meeting in the council chamber, with several of his captains coming in from various parts of the galaxy, and it's summarily decided that they have their new mission. Or rather, that they'll expand their original mission to include clones as well. The Republic is not the only one interested in the Hyperlane's Tatooine controls. The Separatists come to pay their respects as well, represented by Viceroy Newt Gunray of the Trade Federation, having learned of the Republic's less than successful attempts. His pitch draws upon the corruption of the Republic, the overreaching of the Senate, the meddling in affairs that don't concern them. And conversely, when you want them to help, they do nothing and solve nothing, since they're overburdened by bureaucracy and everybody needs to have a say, which means nothing ever gets decided. Tatooine, he says, would be much better off in the Confederacy of Independent Systems, where, as the name implies, they will have more independence. Shmi and the other Tatooineans listen calmly and attentively until he has finished speaking. You raise valid points, she says. We do value our independence highly, and there do seem to be many problems with the Galactic Republic. We would be honored to enter into an alliance with you, and perhaps even seek to join the Confederacy. But we will not work with anyone who uses, benefits from, or condones slavery.
Slaves? What slaves? We've never had any slaves.
This is, of course, not entirely true. Slavery is legal on several of the worlds in the Confederacy, and several others profit from it, even if they're not actually involved in the trade themselves. Shmi knows this, but that is not actually what she's talking about. She knows Annie's dealing with those worlds. I mean the droids that your army relies on, Shmi says calmly, in the face of his spitting outrage.
Droids? They are machines, not slaves. I thought you, of all people, would know the difference, he sneers.
Several of the Amavikan bristle at the implied insult, but Shmi remains calm. Are droids not both sentient and sapient? Do they not have personalities, preferences, and beliefs? Who are we to say that they're less than us? The Trade Federation delegation spatters out more objections. The droids that they have brought with them as protection are suspiciously still and frozen. And she can only guess at how they're taking this. The talk ends with both parties unsatisfied, and the Separatists don't stay for dinner or stay the night. Tatooine, and by extension the freed worlds that used to belong to the Hutts and the Zajirians, remain independent and neutral in the Galactic War. Chancellor Palpatine is not worried. The Outer Rim has always been chaotic, and since it offers very little of worth, he doesn't actually care who controls the hyperspace lands on the Outer Rim, and they'll be crushed again when he is ready to reveal his empire, he decides to let the situation develop organically for now. Let them have these few years of freedom. It will give them a chance to wreck the economic system and create political chaos, giving him an excuse to swoop in as a rescuer. Of course, he doesn't have to set it up so he is the rescuer. Their defenses and army are laughably primitive and small, but he would prefer to have them docile and in awe of him as a ruler, just to make things easier. In fact, the unrest on the Outer Rim strengthens his position. It ties the Republic closer when they don't just have to contend with the Separatists, but also with the organized pirates and terrorists. By the time Palpatine realizes that he should have paid more attention to the Skywalkers and Tatooineans, it's far too late. He will never convert them to his side. He's too tightly tied to slavers in their minds, and they are more stubborn and successful than he could ever have imagined.